The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero.
Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yeah.
Should read that more like the criminologists. I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey. Long pause. You watch the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and like, without a live audience, just sort of in the quiet of your living room.
Mm-hmm.
That is a slow-moving film.
There are bits.
There are a lot of lulls in the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
There are bits. And as I've said before, the dinner scene in Rocky Horror Picture Show is maybe the slowest-paced scene in movie history.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and it comes on a long tradition of lurid, yelly dinner scenes, of which we'll be talking about tonight.
Indeed, because tonight, or today, depending on when you're not listening to it, I guess you could watch it, but it's not very interesting.
you could watch the podcast if you had synesthesia. Yeah.
Well, you can watch it if you just, like, sort of see the little line scroll across whatever player you have.
I suppose
it's just,
right.
I don't think you're going to get a lot out of it.
You haven't introduced yourself
My name
yet.
Is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic, and you can call me your royal sex machine.
And tonight we are talking, or today, we are talking, why are we doing that? We're talking about a film from director Elia Kazan that was incredibly controversial, that was very flagrant in its discussion of sexuality. It is also incredibly campy and also features a lot of themes that the Rocky Horror Picture Show would enjoy to a great extent. We're talking about the Oscar-nominated, very weird film, Baby Doll.
This is the 19-year-old Baby Doll. She wouldn't let her husband come near her. She wouldn't let the stranger go away.
Mr. McCarroll, you certainly are getting familiar.
Don't you have any fun-loving spirit about you?
Well, this isn't fun.
Her name is Carol Baker. She has the same special raw electricity you found before only in Marlon Brando and James Dean.
I find you different this evening.
Never mind that. Just go while he's still on the phone.
Grown up suddenly.
I feel cool and rested for the first time in my life.
Baby Doll was written by Tennessee Williams, based on a one-act play of his, the title of which is, I just had it in front of me and it vanished, 27 Wagons Full of Cotton.
Yeah.
And Tennessee Williams was going to try to turn the screenplay into a full-length play in turn, but that full-length play never manifested.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very much in keeping with Tennessee Williams' interests. It's set in the South, it's set in a very hot day, and it is about tensions within kind of a crumbling Southern estate coming to a head.
Yeah.
The setup for the movie is Carl Malden plays a one-time cotton millionaire who has lost his fortune. He's fallen on hard times. His cotton gin works, but he doesn't have the cotton to gin in it.
Yeah, all he has is the cotton gin. He has a nice estate that is crumbling Grey Garden style.
Yeah,
like all around him.
All the furniture has been repossessed, so there's no furniture in this gigantic house. Tennessee Williams is clearly making a very salient political point about the crumbling edge of pre-Civil War South slavery-driven riches.
Yeah.
and how now it is just sort of like a pathetic echo of what it once was.
They are clinging to the iconography of wealth while they themselves are actually destitute.
Yeah, and they all don't have like any kind of savvy or wherewithal. Mm-hmm. They were just sort of coasting for generations, and now it's finally crumbling and falling apart.
So Carl Malden plays this guy, Archie Lee, and the other thing that he has, to his credit, or to his detriment, rather, is a wife, and she is a lot younger than he is. He married an 18-year-old girl 2 years ago. She is played by Carol Baker, who was nominated for an Academy Award for this.
And she's great in this
movie. She's really good.
Yeah.
I
mean, the three leads are all great.
Everyone's good in this movie. Was nominated for four Academy Awards. Carol Baker was nominated for an Academy Award. The woman who plays her aunt Rose Comfort, played by Mildred Dunnock. Mildred Dunnock won an Academy Award. No one won.
It wasn't quite that successful.
And it was the film debut of Eli Wallach and Rip Torn, who has a very small role in which he looks nothing like Rip Torn.
Like he was on camera, like you can see his face.
Yeah,
and he has several lines, but I did not recognize Rip Torn.
Not even slightly.
I don't think I'd ever seen him as a young man before.
I'd
come to Rip Torn when he was already like maybe in his 50s.
Like the 80s. When I knew him. And even the 70s, you go back, he still looked like older Rip Torn. Yeah. In any case, he was nominated for Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Black and White Cinematography, which they used to split cinematography in two different categories for a while there. In any case, he married an 18-year-old girl. She is about to turn 20 in a couple of days. And they had a contract which says he's going to marry her. Like, her father was dying, and he wanted to know that his daughter was taken care of. Mm. So he said, I'll marry her to you, this rich cotton gin guy. And they've fallen on hard times, but he agreed at the time that because she was so young, he wouldn't do anything. He wouldn't touch her. There would be no sexual congress.
That is sexually. They weren't going to have sex until her 20th birthday.
Yes. And that is coming up, and Carl Malden is very much looking forward to it in a very creepy way. The movie opens with Carl Malden, like, peeking through a hole in a wall.
He's clearly been digging for a long time.
We don't know their relationship yet. All we see is Carl Malden yelling at some guys in the yard, so he clearly lives there. And then he goes inside this weird, dilapidated, creepy mansion. And then there's Carol Baker, and she's sleeping in, like, the one bed they have, which is actually
A baby crib.
Large baby crib with, like, some of the slats removed for people, you know, so older people can put their legs up. And he's staring at her sleeping through a hole in a wall, like in the movie Psycho. And you don't know the context.
Yeah.
It's actually not clear for a while that he's supposed to be married to her. And all we know is that
this weird, like, lacy fetish, like, kind of outfit.
It's called a baby doll gown.
It's called a baby doll gown because of this movie.
Yeah.
It's
a slip. She's wearing a slip.
I knew about the movie Baby Doll. I had heard of a baby doll nightgown.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were associated. So. Indeed. Now I have another little connection in my brain.
And I think it's really interesting that the movie understands just how gross their whole relationship is. It's not like, they're married and that's fine. It's like, no. They're married and it's fucked up that they're married.
Yeah,
they should not be married. It's totally wrong, and it's completely lascivious and creepy and disturbing, and he is clearly a predator who just happens to be married to her.
This is a movie about desperation. Not just financial desperation, but desperate lust. And indeed, that is what is now filling this mansion. All the furniture has been pushed out by this desperate lust. Because all he can do is fixate on this young woman that he's married to.
Yeah, all he wants to do is make her happy and make her feel like she would be willing to be his bride in a more biblical sense. And his only thing he can do is spend money trying to fix this mansion and make it look nice, but there's no furniture in it, and his business is crumbling, and he has nothing left.
Yeah, and she, with the eve of her 20th birthday coming up, begins to feel a desperate crunch to escape.
Yeah.
She wants to get out of the house.
Yeah.
And, get away from this creepy guy who's just, like, leering at her and pawing at her when she's in the bathtub and stuff.
She keeps threatening to move out and, like, stay at a hotel. And he's like, what are you going to do for money? And she's like, I'll do something. I don't know.
And she's like, we're going to go into town. What am I going to do? I'm going to look for a job. It's like, you can't do that. You have to.
Yeah.
I'm your wife. Do what I say. And, he kind of begrudgingly accepts. And there's an early portion in the movie where they do go into town, and she decides to start looking for a job. And there's a that little exchange with Rip Torn, who's the young dentist.
He has a help wanted sign outside of his window. And
he says, I need somebody who can type. Can you type? Well, no. And you see in this really, like, a lot of subtle things in this brief exchange, how she has kind of lost the ability to communicate with people outside of the other than Carl Malden.
Yeah.
Like, her language has been stilted by her cloistering.
And she's been cloistered by her father. She doesn't have, like, and she mentions later on in the film that she had, like, been out with other boys, but every time they did, like, she basically had to learn to be completely defensive around men. Like, oh, there are boys, and they'll say they'll take you to a movie theater, but then they take you out to the rock quarry, and the only thing you can do is run away and throw rocks at them until they promise to take you back. Like, her sexuality has been the bane of her existence. Mm-hmm. It is not a source of her own agency. It is not a source of... it may be a source of power in a weird reverse way, because she can use it.
She can manipulate her abusers, but that's the only way she's able to wield her body, which is the only thing the men have told her she has.
Yeah, they tell her she has nothing else going for her.
But what I like about the character is she's not just desperate. She actually has a lot of wherewithal and has a lot of agency. It's just a matter of her years of being cloistered and abused has sort of stymied her ability to break free.
Yeah. No, so, it becomes a cycle. She's trapped.
Yeah.
And that level of them being trapped leads to desperation. And if there's one thing Tennessee Williams knows, it's that being trapped leads to desperation.
Yeah.
I haven't seen every play Tennessee Williams ever did. They were actually quite prolific, but every single one I've seen seems to be about people who feel trapped in a situation, either geographically or familially or through marriage. And it just turns their life into living hell. Also, it's always really hot and sweaty.
Yeah.
Because they all take place in, like, the Deep South. And it's very humid area, based on every single time I've ever been there.
Yeah. Tennessee Williams' plays are full of sweat. He did Streetcar Named Desire, hot. Mm-hmm. Everybody's in, like, ripped underwear just because it's so hot. That was just sort of his motif.
Yeah, he did melodramas set in hot. He did Cat in a. It wasn't Cat on a moderately warm tin roof. it was Cat on a hot tin roof. That was important. Yeah. It wasn't Suddenly Last Spring. It was Suddenly Last Summer when it was hot. I'm just saying.
It wasn't Night of the Polar Bear, a nice cuddly animal. It was Night of the Iguana.
Yeah.
A desert animal. Yeah. They're all of his plays.
I've never really thought of it before, but it actually does work. That's actually an okay observation.
Yeah. His plays are all evocative of sweat and, taking off clothes and also lust. But the lust in Tennessee Williams' plays is never like a fun, lascivious kind of lust.
No, it's never playful. It's always
it's an affliction in his plays. And indeed, there's going to be a scene in Baby Doll later on where the Eli Wallach character is talking to Baby Doll, and how he is savvy enough to he has her pegged right away.
Yeah,
he understands how trapped she is. How she's sort of at this crossroads of being able to perhaps leave Carl Malden, and he is able to sort of wield his own sexuality to sort of counter what she's been using as a defense mechanism against him.
Which is also incredibly creepy, but it's fascinating to see the give and take of the actors.
It's creepy, but you can see that it's sort of a power play between the two of them. Like, he's not actually trying to creep on her in a lascivious way. Well, maybe a little bit. That's the source of a lot of the drama. Yeah. But that she is feeling, like, and she starts to, like, actually fall for his, like, some of his seductive techniques, and, like, he's getting, like, really physically close to her and saying some really lascivious things, and she's responding to
it. What Carl Malden has been doing throughout their entire relationship is basically just say, I'm your husband, you owe me.
Yeah.
And what Eli Wallach, in another creepy way, because he has a lot of power in that scenario and she has none, but he is, at the very least, attempting to turn her on.
Yeah.
Like, to actually make the sexual dynamic between them pleasurable.
Right.
And that's something that she has never, apparently, ever experienced before. And it leads to a lot of confliction Is confliction a word? Conflict. Means a lot of conflict. All right. But the main plot outside of the baby doll stuff, and it's important, is Carl Malden's cotton gin is no one's ginning any cotton, which I assume is something you do with cotton.
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. See, we're off and rolling. Mm. And the reason why he's not getting any work is because Eli Wallach has not that long ago moved into town and basically taken over the entire cotton industry. And he's in the middle of basically having a big party talking about, hey, this is really, really great. I'm glad I could give you all jobs. Thank you for helping me make my cotton. Oh, you got me flowers. Thank you so much. I'm so glad I could help your community. Carl Malden runs out of a building and the mouth of cotton gin is on fire. And he's like, oh, it's the 1950s. Fudge. Can't say that for you.
People cussed in the 50s, yeah. But they didn't put it in the movie.
And it's weird because you couldn't say, like, the F word. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't say, you know, other, like, you know, sort of, swear words that we would now say even on, like, basic television. But there's a lot of racial slurs in this movie.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
really openly.
The casual racism is pretty, yeah, pretty pervasive.
It's pretty bad, and again, these are words that are way worse than the F word. Like, way worse. And obviously bad people are saying them. Like, but, like, is, we're still, it's pretty shocking, actually, when you see a movie that's trying to watch its language, and then it just lets those fly, yeah, and you're like, what the fuck?
This might be the earliest film I've seen to use the N-word.
I think the Dam Busters, although it wasn't in this context.
Oh, that's right. It was the name of the dog.
Yeah, yeah, which is still offensive, but it wasn't in the exact same context. Yeah. But I still think it was, I think it was before this.
Before this, the earliest film that I remember hearing that word was The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yeah.
And that one, it's used, it's like weaponized in that film. It's actually sort of a point that he used that word.
Yeah.
Because there's a black man serving this guy, and he's preparing something for a heist, and the other man's trying to be, like, really, really friendly to him. It's like, hey, can I help you out? Can I do something for you? And he throws the N-word at him to get him to go away.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like,
because I'm planning a felony here. Yeah, he's still fucked up, though.
But he's fucked up character, that's is the point. And that actually says a lot what's going on in the scene.
I know. It's just amazing that you would never do that now. You would never do that scene now. No, never. No,
like, not even if you were making a period piece.
No, I think that would just be, like, just too shocking. Like, it should be.
And in this one, it's set in a racist time shocking. And place and was made in a racist time. Yep. So the words are just sort of casually dropped. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's even more shocking in this context.
And what's interesting is that when you look at...
Like, it's never not shocking.
No, of course it is. But you know what I mean? Like, there was a time when it was... But what's weird about it is we like to think... You know, now that, like, oh, yeah, you know, it was a different time or whatever. If you look up, like, what people were offended by in this movie, the racist language is actually one of the things that, like, the Catholic League and people were actually saying, like, this movie's kind of fucked up.
Uh-huh.
And the racist language was part of that. So people were having this conversation even at the time. It's just other things tended to take up the most, like, headline space.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Eli Wallach has lost his cotton gin, but he has all this cotton, and it really needs to be ginned.
Yeah.
What is
it? Just
what
look it up, all right?
Okay, fine. All right.
Kind of an important part of American history.
Anyway, I don't know a lot about, like, textiles. The only person in town who has a working cotton gin right now is Carl Malden, which is pretty much why Carl Malden did that. So he's... But here's the thing is he knows Carl Malden did it. He doesn't have evidence. Uh-huh. He doesn't have concrete evidence anyway. But he knows he did it. But the thing is that Carl Malden is, like, part of the community and, like, the police are completely corrupt and they don't care because, oh, if Carl Malden did it, he must have had a reason. So we're just going to back his play. And Eli Wallach is also Italian there's a lot of racism against him in this, which is... interesting because oftentimes racism against Italians isn't so directly discussed in a lot of movies. Anyway, so he's got to go to Carl Malden to get the job done, to get his money.
Yeah.
But he knows that once he's there, he's going to ruin some shit.
Yeah.
He's going there to get the job done, but also to take revenge on Carl Malden however he can. Carl Malden like pretends everything's fine. It's like, ha ha, yes, good neighbor policy. I'm happy. I'll give you the usual rate for the cotton gin, even though you're desperate. And he's like, okay, so I'm going to take care of all this cotton gin with you and your with your workers. Hey, Eli Wallach, why don't you just stay here with my 19-year-old stifled wife all day? It doesn't go great.
It does not. And,
it does not.
Yeah, and the entire second act of the movie is the interaction between Eli Wallach and Baby Doll.
Yeah.
And how you can tell that what is the character's name?
It's Eli Wallach's character's name.
Like Corso or something.
Silva Vaccaro.
Vaccaro.
Yeah.
Vaccaro is there to essentially enact revenge, but as he's doing so, he's learning a lot about Carl Malden.
And he's learning how pathetic he is.
Exactly. Yeah. And is clearly feeling a lot of glee in learning how pathetic this guy is and how poor he is and how bad his relationship with his wife is. And when he gets to go in the mansion, is just sort of learning how it's turned into this sort of like twisted shell of a place, this once palatial estate, which is now just a den of depravity.
The kitchen
is what movie
repulsive.
Did that remind you of? Which is, you know, a big inspiration for the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
This castle is now just a den of depravity.
Yeah.
And if you go to the end of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, when Frank is ultimately punished for his hedonism and is lasered to death by Riff. Yeah, your mission is a failure, your life sentence
The laser wasn't directly inspired by Baby Doll.
There are no lasers in Baby Doll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The original draft had more lasers.
Vaccaro does not whip out a laser gun and start shooting at Carl Malden.
Ilya Kazan dramatically rewrote the screenplay. He did, actually. actually. But anyway.
Brad and Janet sort of go into this, you know, Frankenfurter Castle. It's, of course, more inspired by the old Dark House, which we've already talked about.
Right.
But yeah, this idea that a once palatial thing is now turned into a den of depravity is this American version of what the Rocky Horror Picture Show was doing, the British version of.
Yeah.
One was the fall of the British aristocracy, and one was the fall of, I guess you could call it the Southern aristocracy.
Yeah, or what people like to think of it as. But what's interesting is that patron or the owner of the mansion, Frankenfurter, is actually more of an Eli Wallach character.
Yeah.
They have power, they have sexual agency, and they take one look at Brad and Janet. And they realize that these are people who are incredibly naive, people who have not come into their own sexually, and someone that Frankenfurter can prey upon, which is to a humiliating extent. The thing that empowers Frank, depowers them, and ultimately runs the risk of destroying them, which is something that Eli Wallach is going to try to do.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, it's presented as sort of like fun and playful, but when you get to the very end of the movie, it's about how Brad and Janet are just completely ruined by the experience.
Yeah. Whereas, ironically, Baby Doll, initially it seems really terrifying, then it takes a turn towards the campy and surreal, and then it ultimately comes across, I'm not sure how effectively it does, but the attempt at the end is to make this ultimate experience feel kind of empowering for Baby Doll, and I'm not entirely sure that reads. I think ultimately it just feels like we're trapped in the cycle, but there's an extended sequence, like long, because it's based on a play, it's a long sequence between Eli Wallach and Carol Baker, where he's attempting to seduce her, she sometimes is interested, sometimes is not. One time she feels as though he's actually attacking her, and she runs to Carl Malden for help, and he throws something at her because he's working, and basically just says, go back to your attacker. And then they gradually kind of start to bond. And then it leads to this really weird bit where Carol Baker goes inside and says, you wait right here. I am going to go inside and make lemonade. You are not allowed in the house. Well, there was no, my aunt Rose is not here right now. You are not allowed in the house while I'm here.
Right.
So she goes in the house to make lemonade. And Eli Wallach, as soon as her back is turned, sneaks into the house and starts doing things like moving like the lights around and like stacking chairs just when she's like out of the room, like in that movie, The Sixth Sense, to try to make her think the house is haunted. we just went there. That's where we decided to go. And then it ends with like them chasing each other around the house in a Scooby-Doo sequence.
Yeah, there's a lot of doors slamming and trapping people in attics and yelling like, through like underneath doorways. Yeah,
there's a static shot of a hallway with a series of doors and like there's like three, like one in the foreground, one in the middle, one in the background. Mm-hmm. And like Carol Baker runs in the one in the background and then Eli Wallach runs like after her and then she shows up in the door in the foreground and it just turns into absurdity.
Yeah.
Like, it just becomes weird. And then he like chases her into the attic, at which point the attic is crumbling. And she's, like, clutching, like, the attic floorboards for dear life so that she won't fall into the house and die. And that's when he reveals that what he really wants from her isn't sex. What he wants from her, although, clearly, I don't think he would have turned it down. But
I don't think that's part of his M.O., though. It's in his
repertoire. But what he wants is a signed confession saying, "Your husband burned down my cotton gin."
Yeah.
And so he, like, puts it on, like, a plank of wood and, like, moves it over to her rather than, like, rescue her or anything like that. And says, "You sign that and I'll let you, and I won't, like, let you fall and die."
Yeah.
Which is weird because after this, she's totally into him. Weird.
It is a little odd.
And again, like, she's led such a weird, sheltered life that, like, I get that, like, any variation has more of an allure than what she's going through.
A different kind of power dynamic.
Yeah, and it's a complicated, like, Tennessee Williams wrote, like, characters whose life of desperation pushes them to do some remarkable and in some cases unfathomable things.
Yeah.
But what we have to understand isn't necessarily the motivation for specifically what they do, but rather the motivation itself.
Yeah.
And if we can understand the motivation itself, we can forgive them if they do things that we wouldn't do or that we find difficult to comprehend. Or at the very least, that's the idea. I don't think it always works. And I think Baby Doll pushes it. And then after that, Carl Malden comes home and he finds out that something happened. And he is not happy about it. And it leads to a really awkward dinner.
Yeah.
Which Whitney had already prefaced. Talk about the dinner, Whitney.
The dinner is greens. And Carl Malden is outraged. That he feels like he's been hoodwinked.
Yeah.
And so this dinner, he's not going to have anything to do with this dinner.
It's not going to be a polite dinner.
And Aunt Harriet. Aunt Rose. Aunt Harriet's
Baby Doll is living with her aunt, who is a very sweet kind of Una O'Connor-ish lady.
Yeah, for a split second, I thought it was Una O'Connor. It's like, this is actually long after she had died, I believe. But
it's Mildred Dunnick. Mm-hmm. And but she's a very sweet, but kind of like scatterbrained lady. Like, she like, "Oh yes, I had a stew on, but I forgot to turn on the stove all day, so all we have are greens and they're cold."
So here's some cold greens, and Carl Malden's really, really upset about this. And like, there's only like three chairs in this little tiny table where they can eat, so they have to sort of get up and alternate standing at the table to eat these cold greens that they're not interested in. Mm-hmm. And they're all just sniping at each other and full of hatred. Golly, I love scenes like this where everybody's sitting around a dinner table just seething at one another.
Mm-hmm.
We saw another one of these in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Yeah.
It's just a grand cinematic tradition.
Anytime you have the you're expected to put on airs of politeness. And all you really want to do is throw things at each other.
Yeah.
It's always leads to great cinema. Yeah.
Oh, you shouldn't be too far off. "Hey, this coffee tastes like it came out of an oil derrick. What, just strain it through a mummy?" "Coffee tastes like mud. Roger, mud." The middle of dinner, my steak got up. The steak got up off of my plate and beat the hell out of my coffee. And the coffee was too weak to defend itself.
Yes, I also saw the was it It Conquered the World episode?
It was It Conquered the World. Yeah. There was a scene like that in It Conquered the World, and they riffed on that in Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, good times.
Yeah, I love those jokes.
Yeah. And of course, it all ends with Carl Malden completely losing his mind.
Yeah, he's the one who's on edge, and Eli Wallach totally has the upper hand, and just manipulates him and just starts getting at him and sinking his teeth into Carl Malden. And after all of this has sort of come to a head, he announces to Carl Malden, "Yeah, I'm just renting. I can afford to rent your gin. I'm getting a lot of money from processing all this cotton. you're screwed out of all of this. I'm taking advantage of you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, you burned down my cotton gin, and not only have I, like, kind of taken over, like, your whole business, but you know how you kicked out Aunt Rose? I'll take her with me.
Yeah.
I'll take her. Yeah, she's fine. She's mine now. Also, your wife prefers me. Bye! And so Carl Malden, like, you know, gets a gun and starts running around shooting everything inside, and will he or will he not get Eli Wallach? And we won't bother going through the last scenes. Suffice it to say, not a lot is actually resolved. It's not a matter of, like, oh, Carl Malden's gonna, like, you know, fall off a cliff and that will be his comeuppance. It's like, no, everything's just kind of fucked forever. It looks like things might get a little better. It probably won't. Eli Wallach looks like he might be, like, in a weird, perverse way, the salvation of certain characters. He probably won't.
No,
nothing is going to change. Nothing's going to get any better. It's just this was a particularly wild day. And, I mean, that's a vibe, isn't it? That's a vibe. It's such a sleazy film,
It's... It's sleazy, it's lascivious, but at the same time, I don't think it's sort of bringing people in with the promise of all these, like, lurid things, but this isn't a fun film.
No.
This isn't about, it's not like...
I don't use sleazy as a compliment. I mean, I find it neutral. It's just a matter of, like, this is, like, the kind of...
Yeah, sleazy is just a descriptor.
Yeah. There are good sleazy movies and bad sleazy movies. Hmm. Yeah.
But I don't think this is the kind of film that, even though it promises a lot of sexuality, isn't one of those films that's sort of presenting a sex in an uncomfortable framework, but is also still using it to be really kind of alluring. Mm-hmm. You'll see this in, and this is a one of the most unfortunate trends in B filmmaking is... using scenes of sexual assault as a way to titillate audiences.
As an excuse to get nudity.
Yeah, like, we need nudity really in this film, so why don't we just have a scene of sexual assault? Well, no, that's horrendous. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is not trying to titillate the audience.
Yeah. Although,
at all. There's like, some nude scenes and a lot of talk of sex, but it's all wielded in this really uncomfortable sort of way.
Well, and that's the thing. I feel like, in context, the movie it's gross, but it knows it's gross. And I feel like that's... I'm not entirely sure it's making enough of a point to really justify that. I feel like ultimately it devolves into more of like just a weird camp oddity after a while.
Yeah.
It's clearly supposed to be like darkly comedic, but I think it veers so far in that direction with the whole haunted house bit, and it never quite recovers. Mm. But part of the problem, and this is one of the reasons why like the Catholic League denounced it, was, you know, it wasn't presented in context. Like the image of Carol Baker as a young woman, like, sleeping in, like, a crib, sucking on her thumb, was part of the marketing.
Yeah.
And marketing doesn't present context.
No.
It doesn't. No. I don't care if there's a log line that suggests context. People are taking away the image. They're not scanning all the text on the billboard. They're just looking at the billboard. And that sets up an expectation of what's supposed to be in this movie. And, you know, that the movie... is trying to use the subject of sexuality to make dark and unpleasant points discuss sexuality as a means of humiliation and abuse is undermined by the fact that the sexuality is considered the selling point.
Yeah.
And as such, we expect that if the sexuality is a selling point, we're supposed to enjoy it. And that's not the case in this film.
No. And I think what Tennessee Williams was really kind of getting at was how sex and sexuality are ultimately sort of like the final corrupting force in this fallen former kingdom. Mm-hmm. I think he was being very poignant about the way wealth had been vaunted and sex had been kind of ignored as part of this myth of the South.
Interesting.
And I think he's trying to just like smash the last bricks into the ground of an already crumbling mansion.
That's not quite what I took away from it. Okay. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, the social class of Carl Malden's character had long been taken away from him, and it had been given to an immigrant, and And that leaves him feeling very, very small. And then on top of everything, like the cherry on top of his demasculization or emasculization, is he has a young and beautiful wife who doesn't want to touch him.
Yeah.
His sexuality is like the last thing that gets taken from him.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't even, and at the end of this movie, he can't even pretend that he has any power.
Yeah.
Like, he was at least able to pretend because he had a contract, but now he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been taken from him. All of this sort of white male bravado, this sort of, like, I own the cotton gin, I have, like, the big house with the fancy columns, I married the young debutante, everything is mine, and in the end, it turns out that that was all a facade for an incredibly weak type of person.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part of it that I can respond to, and that's the thing that gets most interesting out of. I feel like a lot of the other stuff with a lot of the other characters doesn't really land, but I feel like Carl Malden's failure as a human being comes across. And I feel like what he represents, that being a failure, I think that's what matters.
Yeah. And
I just get it from a different angle.
Yeah. He's, like, it's called Baby Doll, and she's the title character, but I think it's Carl Malden's story, and it's about his failure as a human being, and I think he does. And the reason I was taking this is I'm trying to think of, like, what he represents. It is a very personal story, and we can just sort of take it as the drama of a fallen man.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that he was, because it's a cotton gin, and because they use racial slurs, and because of its setting, it does evoke images of antebellum South.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what Tennessee Williams was trying to deconstruct.
Yeah, this is the last vestige of it. It's dying now.
All we have is
a desperate
man in... This is the end of the road. A desperate man consumed by an unsavory kind of lust with a cotton gin with no cotton in it.
Yeah.
And only an immigrant can bring cotton in and sort of take it from him.
Yeah.
So yeah, he I think he was very actively trying to tear something down with Baby Doll.
I just think the camp overloads it after a while, and we start losing the forest for the trees a little bit.
Maybe a little bit, but I think it's always there.
True. This is Eli Wallach's first, it's Torrance's first movie, but he only has one scene. This is Eli Wallach's first movie, and he's like the second or third lead, depending on how you look at it. He's certainly in the top three people in the cast, and holy shit, what a debut.
Yeah, like, it's a big one.
It's a big one, and it really is a great showcase for Eli Wallach, who I think is just one of the great actors of the second half of the 20th century. He always gave 110%, and he was never afraid to let a character, even if the character was normal on the page, demonstrate eccentricity. And I think as a result, many of his even bizarre... his bizarre characters feel real, and his real characters feel bizarre enough to be more real.
Yeah.
Because people are weird. Some actors forget this. Some actors try to normalize everyone they meet and try to make them seem, you know, sort of an everyman. Eli Wallach was not concerned about that shit.
Yeah. One of his most famous roles was the film with Sergio Leone.
The Good, the Bad,
the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
He was the ugly.
No, he was the good.
No.
I saw him as the good.
Well, but he's specifically labeled as the ugly.
I suppose so.
Like, in the title, it says that Clint Eastwood is the good, Lee Van Cleef is the bad, and Eli Wallach is the ugly. But you're right. By the end of the film...
He's the only one that, like, has some kind of principle. I felt like Clint Eastwood was the bad, and Lee Van Cleef was the ugly.
I feel like the whole heart and soul of the movie is when Eli Wallach, like, meets, like, his brother, and his brother became a priest, and he's so disappointed in him. Mm. But at the end, even though he's, like, you know, this... rollicking, you know, violent, you know,
lascivious dude.
Yeah, like in the end when he's like riding away with Clint Eastwood, he's talking about what a great time he had reminiscing with his brother and how much they loved each other. And it's just like, oh, more humanity than we're going to see from Eastwood.
Yeah.
You know,
Eastwood is just sort of, they call him the man with no name. He's called Blondie in the movie.
He has a name in all three films.
It's like,
I forget what the other ones are, but he has a name in all three films. Yeah, it's hilarious. But, I think he has no name because it changes in all three films, I think.
But he's a good... What I was going to say is Eli Wallach is a good pairing with a director like Sergio Leone, who directs these incredibly hyper-real movies where things don't exist unless they're in frame, for instance. Like, somebody is, like... marveling something. Oh no, they're coming toward me. And we see their foot like step into camera. And that's like when they exist for the person.
Yeah.
When really they're on this gigantic plane and they would have seen them coming for an hour.
Yeah.
That kind of like non-reality is what really pushes forward a lot of Sergio Leone's movies. Mm-hmm. And Eli Wallach works really well in that kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
He's able to play these hyper-real characters where he's over the top and really non-human in a way, but feels superhuman as a result.
Yeah, Elia Kazan as a filmmaker tends to be known for more like sort of humanistic type films. So Baby Doll feels a little weird. Baby Doll feels it's
out of his wheelhouse. It's really over the top. The other films of his I've seen.
Yeah, and you can see why. Like, and Baby Doll is explicitly referenced in Rocky Horror. I believe it's in the actual crib is in Columbia's like room.
Yeah, yeah.
So
everybody shoved him. I really very nearly loved him that scene. Yeah.
So like Columbia is clearly modeled after a Baby Doll type character. She's like the youngest member in the cast, at least until Susan Sarandon comes along. That's nebulous, but. She's clearly been sort of taken in by older, more sexually aggressive people, and she doesn't probably know any existence beyond that. And now she's just bouncing around this crumbling mansion trying to make something of herself, and I actually consider her arguably the most sympathetic character in that movie. I also think that I think the makers of Rocky Picture Show understood that this is where camp comes from. Camp comes from, like, desperation. Camp comes from an attempt to do something real, but from people who are pushed to do things that seem unreal. And I think it comes across. I think it's fascinating. I'm glad I saw this. It's definitely not, like, going to enter my favorite film lexicon, but it's an interesting watch.
Yeah, it's not an earth-shattering class. I mean,
it's arguably whatever, classic.
If you want to use the word classic, you may. But yeah, it's a little bit of a weird directing job for Elia Kazan. It's a little bit of a weirdly paced movie. Has some really excellent performances in it. Mm. And in terms of its confrontation of using a floating fog of desperate sexuality as the final... element of downfall of a previously grand aristocracy is something that it shares with the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
Rocky Horror Picture Show came from England, and you can tell that a lot of the Rocky Horror Show and the Rocky Horror Picture Show were both doing was confront a polite society. And they chose, you know, Brad and Janet are the face of polite society in that movie.
Yeah.
And it's sort of confronting them with sex, but at the same time, by the end of the movie, we do see that it's gone too far and that the aristocracy is ultimately going to be destroyed by lust.
Yeah.
I think the Rocky Horror Picture Show is doing something a little bit more playful with it. I think it's riffing on those themes rather than making a much more poignant point about the British aristocracy, whereas Baby Doll is incredibly earnest.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're using the same words, even if they're singing slightly different songs.
That's it for this episode of Episode Zero. Next week, we'll be back with three films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're doing an entire trilogy. We've talked a lot about the films that inspired elements of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but we haven't talked a lot about not just the horror. We've talked about a few horror films, but we haven't talked a lot about queer horror.
Mm.
And we're going to be looking at arguably the greatest queer vampire period piece trilogy of all time. I assume there are others, but I'm a huge fan. I'm really excited that we're going to get to talk about the Karnstein trilogy, which is a series of three vampire movies made by Hammer Horror with extremely explicit queer themes. They are The Vampire Lovers, Lust for a Vampire, and Twins of Evil. These films are pretty readily available. I think only, like, Twins of Evil is currently, like, available for no extra cost on, like, Amazon Prime or Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
But the other ones are pretty easy to find and rent. And if you see nothing else, I highly recommend seeing The Vampire Lovers. It is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to get to talk to you about it next week with Whitney, who, have you haven't seen any of these?
I haven't seen them. And okay. You've talked them up a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm familiar with their existence, but not too intimately familiar with
them. Yeah, it's this sort of, again, it's another type of movie where, like, there are people who are in the cult and they know all about it. They're like, probably hear you say the Kernstein trilogy and they're like, yeah, like, we're friends. And a lot of people are like, huh? Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can introduce you to some really, really cool films. And I hope you, that's our goal, obviously, all the time. But in this case, I'm very excited. That's coming up next week on episode 0. Thank you everybody for listening. If you want to talk about anything we discussed on this podcast or anything else you might want to discuss with us, you're more than welcome to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email and respond to it on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail, right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Please subscribe if you haven't already. It really helps us out. Leave us a review if you haven't already. Even just a star rating and a couple of sentences just really helps us find more listeners, and it means the world. And if you really want to help out and you have the means, you can always join our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And we have a lot of exclusive shows to reward you for that. We have shows that are dedicated to every single episode of Star Trek ever produced, every single episode of the 1960s Batman, movies that are supposed to be on Disney Plus, or at the least in theory should be because Disney owns them, but are mysteriously not. And we're going to try to figure out why. We have commentary tracks. We are working our way through reviews of every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. And there's a ton of other stuff as well. On over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You can vote for future episodes of things. It's a whole thing. And a very special shout out to all of our patrons, without whom this show and all of our other shows would not exist. And of course, we're on Twitter @criticacclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
This is probably being dropped on May 1st. If it's May 1st, that means it's the first Saturday of the month, and the first Saturday of the month is when we reveal new products in Salt Cat Soap, our Etsy store. If you go to Etsy, look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You will find handcrafted soaps designed by my wife and partner, M. Lapis da Silva, some of them by me. This month we're revealing some actually really cool, exciting new products, including a line of hand lotion that is crafted by us, and it smells really, really nice. It's a really pretty presentation too. I think they look really neat too, on top of just being a great hand lotion. So all of those things are available at Salt Cat Soap. You can also follow Salt Cat Soap on Twitter and Instagram. It's @SaltCatSoap. Look for Luca. He's the logo. He's adorable.
Cute little black kitty.
All right. So thank you, everybody, once again. And until next week, I see you shiver with anticipation.
Jerk.